intrude into our lives, and sometimes they appear unprompted. When I began pondering this, I went first to my Greek New Testament. I wanted to reflect on the meaning of anamnesis in Christian thinking about the dead in that passage about the Last Supper. Then I decided to check the Latin as well, so I went to my Latin New Testament, and a gate to the past opened before me. The Latin New Testament I consulted asserted its own past, as well as incidents in my own. I remembered buying it in Lent 1969 from Thynne's bookshop on South Bridge in Edinburgh, just opposite the old quad of the university. Thynne's, as the bookshop then was, had a rambling second-hand book department in its deep, cluttered basement. That's where I picked it up. It was a handsome, slightly scuffed, leather-bound volume with gilt-edged pages, small enough to slip into a pocket, vigesimo quarto in printer's lingo. It had been published in 1911, and it had been a gift. On the inside cover there was the autograph of Alexander Stewart, St. Mary's College, St. Andrews, and then pasted on the flyleaf at the front was a card that read, "With the Reverend H. J. White's kind regards." In Alexander Stewart's handwriting on the bottom right-hand corner of the card was the date, January 1912. It summoned the past from before the Great War. Who was Alexander Stewart, a common enough name in Scotland? Who was the Reverend H. J. White, whose address, as the bottom left-hand corner of his visiting card informed me, was 33 Lexham Gardens W? Did that unattached W suggest a London address? The mystery is solved on the title page. It tells me in Latin that Henricus Julianus White was one of the editors of this version of St. Jerome's 4th-century translation of the Bible into Latin. It also tells me that he was professor of the interpretation of the New Testament at King's College, London. So my guess was right, a London address. My next guess is that the Reverend H. J. White had sent a copy of his new work of scholarship to Alexander Stewart of St. Andrews University, tucking his business card inside as a "with compliments of the author" slip. Alexander Stewart then glued it onto the fly sheet with the date he received it. My third guess is that Stewart, too, was a theologian, and a quick bit of research proves it. And not just another theologian, he was a very distinguished one. At the time of the gift, he was principal and professor of divinity at the University of St. Andrews and a former moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. He didn't live long after receiving Professor White's gift in 1912. He died unexpectedly in the summer of 1915. H.J. White lived on till 1934. A dead world has been conjured to life on my desk by a 100-year-old book I picked up for 35 pence nearly 50 years ago. How did it end up in Thynne's? I reckon that after his death in 1915, Professor Stewart's library was passed on to his children. A couple of generations later, whatever was left was sold to a book dealer, and some of it ended up in Thynne's labyrinthine basement. As I hold this remnant of Alexander Stewart's library from 1912 and turn its pages to find the verses I am looking for, a card falls out and another memory floods in. It was the requiem card for a beloved friend whose funeral I had conducted 25 years before. My memory of her had gone, yet there she was again, vividly present in my mind. Breast cancer had killed her, and it took its time. It had reduced her beauty to ashes except for the bright shining of her eyes. Her metaphor for death had been the train, not the bus. She knew she'd have to board alone, but she wanted me there up to the last moment. "Make sure you buy a platform ticket," she warned me. Though platform tickets were no longer issued, I knew what she meant. Compartments in the old trains opened directly onto the platform, so tickets had to be checked before passengers boarded. And if you wanted to see someone onto the train, you needed a ticket to get through the barrier to the platform. It meant you could stay beside a friend till she opened the compartment door and went aboard. That's where she wanted me, as close as I could get to her departure. I was there when the train drew in and she boarded. So how could I have forgotten her? I feel faithless and helpless. Time not only steals those we love, it even steals our memories of them. Their graves fill with the dust of the years, and we forget them. Then one day we come upon a card in an old book, and a long-dead friend steps through the door of memory into the present, and we mourn again. It is the absoluteness of the loss we feel after a death that stuns us. At last I am alone. Now there is nothing left. All your papers have been taken away. Your clothes have gone, your room is bare. In a few months no traces will be left. And never again, however long I look out of the window, will I see your tall, thin figure walking across the park, past the dwarf pine, past the stumps, and then climb the ha-ha and come across the lawn. Our jokes have gone forever. It is Carrington's forever in that extract from her diaries about the death of Lytton Strachey that hits us. How can we bear such absolute losses, such complete disappearances? What we've done in our grief is to craft arts of mourning and remembrance, to hold open the door before it closes forever on the beloved dead. Religion has its own memorial arts, and the phrase from Luke's Gospel I was searching for when I found my friend's requiem card captures both their strength and elusiveness. Tutu poieti istein amen anamnesin. Do this in remembrance of me. Anamnesis is a profound word, deeper than the simple act of remembrance. For Plato, anamnesis lay at the heart of his theory of learning. Like the sages of India, he believed that our souls had been repeatedly incarnated, and since we had all forgotten what we had known in previous lives, learning was a process of recall or rediscovery of what had been lost. You do not have to believe in reincarnation to go on finding truth in that idea. We let too much of what is good and beautiful sink into the unremembered past, even the lives of those we loved. And what we are doing when we use our imagination to remember the dead is to bring them to life again, if only for a moment. Not in a séance that magically summons them to appear in our midst, however unwillingly, but through an art of remembrance or anamnesis that is so lovingly felt, we say of it, that it isn't about the person, it is the person herself. In Christianity, this idea of making someone present again after death was mainly applied to Jesus Christ in the Eucharist, the service that commemorated his Last Supper, when he told them to break bread and drink wine as his anamnesis. The Eucharist was not about Jesus, it was Jesus himself present in the forms of bread and wine. Jesus Christ also became the dominant presence in Christian funerals. The Church was more intent on proclaiming the future that awaited the departed in heaven than on remembering the life they had lived on earth. The readings and prayers were all about the life to come, not the life that had just ended. Almighty God, with whom do live the spirits of them that depart hence in the Lord, and with whom the souls of the faithful, after they are delivered from the burden of the flesh, are in joy and felicity. We beseech thee that it may please thee of thy gracious goodness shortly to accomplish the number of thine elect, and to hasten thy kingdom, that we, with all those that are departed in the true faith of thy holy name, may have our perfect consummation and bliss, both in body and soul, in thy eternal and everlasting glory. Prayers of consolation like this were also offered for those who mourned, but the emphasis was on the prospects for the departed. Funerals did not look back, they looked forward, and the prospect could be forbidding. The most striking of Christian funeral services was the Catholic Church's traditional Requiem Mass for the faithful departed. It was a special version of the normal Eucharist with subtle shifts of emphasis and tone. It was celebrated in the presence of the corpse, for whom it was a cry to God for mercy, and it was more somber than the normal Mass. The colour of the vestments was black, sometimes edged with gold to suggest the hope of resurrection, and instead of creamy beeswax, the candles were unbleached dark orange in colour. But the most tremendous addition was the great choral sequence Dies Irae, or Day of Wrath, a dramatic meditation on judgment. As we have already noticed, this fear of eternal damnation hung like a funeral pall over medieval and late medieval Christian thought. The Dies Irae was a plea of the frightened soul to the merciful heart of Christ. Day of wrath and doom impending, David's word with Sibyl's blending, heaven and earth in ashes rending. Oh, what fear man's bosom rendeth, when from heaven the judge descendeth, on whose sentence all dependeth. Death is struck, and nature quaking, all creation is awaking to its judge an answer making. Lo, the book exactly worded, wherein all hath been recorded, thence shall judgment be awarded. What shall I, frail man, be pleading, who for me be interceding, when the just are mercy needing? It's not often heard in churches nowadays, but even in the concert hall, when the great classical requiems are performed, it can send a shiver down our spines. Even if we do not believe in the doom the great hymn fears, there is something about death itself that summons us to consider the heedlessness of our own lives. It prompts us to self-reflection before it is too late. Even in religious funerals today, the emphasis has shifted from the future that awaits the dead to the life they actually lived while on earth. That is certainly the style in memorial services for famous people, where they summon the dead to make their last appearance on the stage before disappearing into the wings forever. In humanist services increasingly prevalent today, there is no focus on the future life because it is neither desired nor expected. The emphasis is all on representing the life that has ended in a final anamnesis. And sometimes the dead are given the last word. In a non-religious funeral I conducted recently, the deceased had carefully crafted a message for me to read in her name. It was a song of gratitude for having lived and a message of love to her partner and daughter, both of whom were immensely comforted by it. Unlike the funerals I conducted as a young priest, where the form was strictly set by the prayer book, the ones I lead today are usually specially crafted to reflect the life that has ended. This can be hard if the life being remembered was incomplete or unfulfilled. That said, it is probably the unfulfilled life that speaks best to those of us who feel we didn't make the most of ours either, and now it's too late. Thinking about lives that didn't quite happen helps us remember that although we didn't deal the hand, we have to play the cards life gave us. The death of a friend who'd been director of music at Old St. Paul's in Edinburgh when I was rector there in the 1970s gave me a chance to reflect on the grace of the apparently unfulfilled life. This is what I said. The novelist Rebecca West claimed that artistic genius was the abnormal justifying itself. Those who know that they are for whatever reason condemned by the laws of life make themselves one with life by some magnificent act of creation. West was saying that creativity had one of its roots in a disconnection between prevailing conventions and the reality of the artist's life. That dissonance was the grit in the soul that became the pearl of great price, wonderful art. I don't want to romanticize Alistair, but I have a strong feeling that all the turbulent and conflicting elements in his character were reconciled when he sat himself down at an organ console and emptied himself into the music. Not being a musician, I can only guess at what that must have felt like. But I too have had moments in my life when I was emptied into something larger, something that cancelled or absorbed the clamours of my own nature and gave me a rest from myself. The technical name for this is ecstasy, which means to get out of or off your own ego with all its needs and posturing and dissonances. I can remember many occasions in this church when we'd got to the end of a great hymn and Alistair would zoom or lift off into a piece of breathtaking improvisation. And you sense that the awkward, abrasive, yet intensely kind man on the organ stool was far away from himself and had become music and resolution and beauty. He had been justified, to use a word with a strong redemptive echo in Christianity, a word that promises that our struggles and self-loathing are destined to be caught up into an enormous mercy and grace that says yes to us, just as we are, and accepts us even though we feel ourselves to be unacceptable. I don't know if musical theorists would agree with me on this, but it seems to me that Fauré's Requiem captures and expresses that same experience of human reconciliation, which is why it is the right setting for Alistair's farewell. It reconciles us to all the dying and going forth that is the human lot and brings forth beauty from loss. It justifies us, brings meaning out of brokenness, and carries us home. Maybe his genius for improvisation is the clue to understanding Alistair and his conflicts with authority over the years. Improvisation is the art of departing from fixed rules and making up new music now heard for the first time. And this is something the authoritarian personality hates. Authoritarians like rules and regulation. They like things done the way they have always been done. That's why when they get control of institutions, they resist change. Their motto is, do nothing for the first time. It is improvisers like Alistair who bring necessary change to moribund societies. Blessed are the improvisers, for they make all things new. So those we love leave us. We see them no longer, but we try to hold on to them as long as we can. In their funerals and memorials, we do our best to contain and express the meaning of the lives we have lost forever. Before the service, we sit in our chairs thinking about them, trying to compress their essence into a few hundred words before closing the curtains on yet another life. Like Dora Carrington, we remember their jokes, the way they walked, their shape. We don't hide from their flaws. In fact, we discover that they were part of why we loved them. they touch the incomplete places in our own souls. Suddenly we realize that what annoyed us about them is what we'll miss most of all, their quirks and absurdities, and we wonder all over again if we told them how much we love them. It is a great pity we don't know when the dead are going to die, so that over a last companionable drink we could tell them how much we liked them. Happy the man who, dying, can place his hand on his heart and say, "At least I didn't neglect to tell the thrush how beautiful she sings." Then it's the day after the funeral. Our friends have gone back to their lives. We want to go back to ours, but no longer know where it is. Its meaning has gone. We are no longer living as we did before. We are grieving. We have known grief before, of course. There have been other losses, but none like this. No other loss prepared us for the loss of death, because there is no loss like it. Our jokes have gone forever. Death is an absolute loss, because she realized she could not live without Lytton Strachey. Carrington killed herself, clumsily, with a shotgun. Grief can kill, quickly as in Carrington's case, or in the slow emotional death of enduring sorrow that takes the life out of life. What is grief, this X that hits us like an express train? Answering that question in writing is like trying to put the experience of music into words. It doesn't easily translate into the language of definition, though we can glimpse it in the experience of others. We heard it in David's lament for his son Absalom, "Would God I had died for thee." We saw it when Carrington pressed the shotgun against a stomach and reached for the trigger to silence grief forever. Grief has as many layers and textures as there are individual circumstances, but its essence is a stunned and sorrowing bewilderment that somebody was here and the next minute there is nobody here at all. It is not only the experience of loss, it is bafflement at the loss and a sense of its impossibility. This cannot be happening. We may not be able to define or describe grief in words, but we can hear it. It has a voice, a sound of its own making, its own music. We describe the words that express this sound, this music, as onomatopoeic. The meaning is in the sound. Hear it, and you know immediately what it is. Keening is one of the words. Ululating is another. They are the sound of loss, its idiomotor effect, and even the most stoical find it hard to repress them, battling tears and suppressing sobs, denying grief expression and escape, bottling it in. Sooner or later, it will have to be released, do its work of protest, make its music heard, or it will divert its pain into self-harm and torment. And that's when grief counselors have to do their work, unclogging the memory, helping us to release the long, silent scream. Any death prompts its own measure of grief and pain, but how the life was lost can add complexity to the grief and extend it, sometimes beyond resolution. Death by suicide, especially a violent and dramatic one, will pile extra layers of anger and guilt onto grief's already heavy load. Why didn't they share their despair? Why didn't we read the signals? Why couldn't we keep them happy? Why weren't we enough for them? How could they do this to us? A death caused by medical negligence can add a sense of betrayal to grief's chemistry. We trusted them with this precious life. We gave it into their care. And the inquiries that follow may prolong its pain for years. The death of a child can exile its parents in the far country of despair. Sometimes it splits them apart. They accuse themselves of failing to protect their child and give their own life for it. Would God I had died for thee. I still see that tiny white coffin on a snowy day in Lanark a lifetime ago. And I remember the funeral of a stillborn child in Edinburgh, whose mother kept saying it was not her daughter's death she mourned, but her future, a future she memorialized in her own life. She would be 18 today. And prejudice can add its poison to the mix. I recall the angry grief of a parishioner whose partner's body was taken away by his parents and buried privately without any acknowledgement that he was gay. There was the woman who told me how she had slipped into the back of the cathedral during the solemn requiem mass for the famous man who had been her lover, and how she had left before anyone could notice her and wonder who she was. Now she was alone with a grief that dare not speak its name. Grief is shattering, but it can be survived if we let ourselves experience it. It has to be done, not bypassed, muffled or diverted. An important part of doing it is anamnesis, the work of remembrance, of going back over the life we have lost as if searching for clues that might solve the mystery of its departure. We can usually do this best with our relatives and friends, but we may have to go to a counsellor or a priest if we get stuck, or if there are issues we can only explore with someone who will hold them in confidence. The dying can help our grieving. They will help if they think ahead and prepare the way for their absence in our lives. The only future life any of us can be certain of is the one we'll have in the memory of those we shall leave behind. Why not plan it before we go? Such as leaving letters that tell them how much we love them and how much they meant to us. Or by leaving instructions about the funeral we want, as long as we realize that it is as much for them as it is about us. Don't mess with their grief by being too prescriptive, like the man I knew who insisted that no eulogy should be delivered at his funeral, thereby frustrating those of us who wanted to celebrate his distinguished life. He left detailed directions about the music and readings he wanted, but forbade any words about himself. It felt like everyone was there except him. He couldn't be bothered to turn up at his own funeral. Plan ahead, and you will help good grief do its work of sorrow and remembering. And keep your plans up to date. I've had to change my funeral plans several times because I keep outliving the friends I want to participate in it. The dying can also hinder our grieving. They can make grief harder for the bereaved than it might otherwise be. They can poison someone's future by forcing them to fret over an unhealed past. Sometimes this is the legacy the dead actually want to bequeath the living. They want their anger to pulse down the years after they are gone. I think of the man who learned on the day his father's will was read how much he had been despised, and how carefully his father had propelled that hatred into the future. He was excluded from the will in an act calculated to deliver a wound he would feel for the rest of his days. How can an act like that ever be reconciled? What must it feel like to know your father wanted you to carry his hatred in your head till your own death? Jesus told us not to let the sun go down on our wrath, to mend a hurt before putting out the light. All the more reason to heal injuries before the light goes out forever. Don't let death go down on your wrath, because you meant to get round to healing that old hurt but never did. Now it may never heal. Religious visions of the abode of the dead as places of eternal bliss or eternal woe can be given a helpful secular meaning. The dead can be thought of as living on in the lives of those who remember them, either in peace or in torment, depending on how their relations were at the end. The dead may be gone, but their karma goes marching on. Try to make good karma for those you leave behind. Don't leave in a way that will corrupt your own memory. Whatever the circumstances that attend a death, grief has to be done. It has to be expressed. The pain has to be endured. We have to get used to the fact that someone who was there has now gone forever. We can leave his pipe in the ashtray if we like. We can avoid the fact that his chair is empty and his jokes have gone forever. Friends can help if they listen to us and let our grief be voiced, however angry it sounds. It is often in grief that the bereaved discover who their real friends are. Some people can't cope with the grief of others because they can't face death and don't want to think about it. There are many stories about new widows and widowers seeing friends coming towards them in the street who suddenly dash to the other side rather than meet them. As if feeling the contagion of death, they avoid all contact with the bereaved. Gradually, almost without knowing it, our energy shifts from the past to the present, from the way things were to the way they are. The will to live that is in the heart of every creature asserts itself again, and life overcomes death, even a death we thought we would never recover from. We may even fall in love again. We may pour our hearts into another life as completely as into the one whose death we thought we could not survive. The future opens before us and we turn towards it. We start living again. If you live as long as I have, you see this happening again and again. You see sorrow unfolding into joy as the years bring their changes. One of the privileges of the priest's life is to be present at both ends of these transformations. Not long ago, a young man came to see me with his fiancée. More than 30 years before, I had conducted his mother's funeral. "Would I marry them?" he asked me. This is what I said at their wedding on a hill in Fife. Forgive me if I begin on a personal note. In 1975, when I was rector of Old St. Paul's on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh, a young nurse called Connie Cuthbertson came in to see me. It was the death of her brother Bobby that brought her in my direction. She told me of her grief and the grief of her parents, who had now lost 2 sons, Andrew having died in 1958. But life moved on, and her sorrow turned to joy when she and Norman married in Old St. Paul's one snowy day in February, and they went over the Forth to run a farm and grow a family on this hill. I was away from Edinburgh for 6 years and came back in 1986 to discover that Connie was dying. I came to see her here, and something she said captured the essence of her personality. Her hair had fallen out, but she told me with a smile that she spread it on the bushes in the garden so that the birds could use it for their nests. That incident captured the grace, kindness, and humour of her soul. Death took her, and again there was sorrow in her family. But sorrow was again followed by joy when Norman married a young widow called Trish, and she brought her sons into this family of large men, the Nevin boys, all built on the scale of Connie's gentle giant of a father, Robin Cuthbertson. Today that story of loss, and the love that overcame it, passes another milestone, as Graham and Amy bind their lives together, whatever the future may hold for them. The most moving thing about a wedding is the way it gathers scattered elements of the past and brings them together into a new future. Amy's story also has its losses and its intriguing connections. Her loving and selfless father Andrew died nearly 3 years ago after a history of heart disease. Drew, as he was known in the family, was a metallurgist who in his 20s had worked for a time for Trish's father. Just file that wee coincidence away for a second, because there are more to come. It's as if some benign force in nature was gently nudging these two fine young people together. And fine they are, each of them working selflessly to care for our planet and all the living creatures whose home it is. They didn't know it, but slowly they were being drawn together. They had friends and interests in common. They liked the same bands, one of them, Whiskey Kiss, playing here today. They went to the same concerts, socialized in the same pubs. They even lived at different ends of the same street. Then one night, with a group of friends in a pub in Toll Cross, their paths finally crossed. A spark was lit, and the courtship began. And being the brave, adventurous people they are, when it came, the marriage proposal wasn't made on Blackford Hill or in a bar in Bruntfield. It happened on a finger of the southern Patagonian ice field in the distant reaches of South America, as far from Leamington Terrace as you can get. So these two beautiful and idealistic young lives were joined, and we have come here today to witness and celebrate their love and offer them the encouragement of our support as they begin their lives together. As well as being an act of promised love, a wedding service is an act of courage in which two people pledge their lives together for the future, no matter what it holds. We know that human life can never fully escape sorrow and may even encounter terrible loss. But we also know that the love people have for each other can withstand whatever the future brings and guide them through its storms. We will surround Amy and Graham with our love as they set out on their journey together today. But before we send them on into the future, we want to look back at two great souls they love but see no longer, Graham's mother Connie and Amy's father Drew. Though in one sense they are no longer with us, in another sense they are, because they are present in their children, as they will be in their children's children. So we look back for a moment now, but not in sorrow, only in joy for what they gave and what their children will carry of them into the long years ahead. And to celebrate that undying link with the past, I now invite Amy and Graham to light these two candles for Connie and Drew, absent today, but carried always in our hearts. 7. The Last Bus. I was phoned recently by someone who had been commissioned by a newspaper to write my obituary. There was a fact he wanted to check and couldn't find the answer to. Would I mind helping him? I was happy to, and it got me thinking about the important role obituaries can play in preparing us for death. We don't any of us know the date of our own death, and it's silly to think it has already been fixed by the omniscient registrar in the sky. But there's a date out there of which in the future they will say, that's the day you died. So in that sense it is fixed, it lies ahead, it is waiting for you. There will be a notice in the newspaper announcing it, along with the time and place of the funeral. There may even be an obituary, a life in 500 words with an old photograph that moves those who love you in a way they can't quite explain. Like the funeral address, the obituary is one of the arts of anamnesis, one of the ways we try to represent a life before it fades into the past. It's a difficult art. Too many of them concentrate on listing achievements and successes, so they read like post-mortem petitions for a public honour. But just occasionally, something of the turmoil of a lived life will come through. They're the ones I like, the ones I profit from. I'm not bothered about how many directorships they had, or how many books they wrote, and the prizes they won. But I do like to read about their struggles with sorrow, or sex, or religion. I like to hear how they played the hand life dealt them. I am helped by the knowledge that, behind the confident public face, the private face was sometimes streaked with tears. The obituaries I devour with particular interest are those of the movie stars of my boyhood, though most of them have already gone. My reasons for this obsession are complicated. It's partly because they take me back to the now of then in the picture palaces of my youth, long before the multiplexes and the shiny rows of concession stands in the lobby. Like many children of my generation, I escaped the constraints of a cramped existence by living vicariously through the glamorous characters up there riding across the silver screen. There was a consoling side to this movie habit that was relatively benign, and it was at its most therapeutic during and in the years immediately after the Second World War. We needed an occasional escape from grey reality, and the imaginary world of the movies provided it. But there was an insidious side to it as well, analysed by the film historian Mark Cousins. He writes, "Hollywood films have an emotional amplitude greater than that of everyday life. Dark clouds hang over them, as they do in romantic poetry and painting, and their stories are drawn against the background of that fate. Theirs is a phenomenally successful brand of emotional excess I refer to as closed romantic realism. I use closed because these films tend to create worlds that do not acknowledge that they are being watched, and the actors behave as if the camera isn't there." It was this closed romantic world that dominated my inner life and its imagined longings when I was a child. Many commentators have remarked on the similarity between cinema-goers and the watchers in Plato's parable of the cave. Plato's watchers face away from the real world outside and concentrate on the hypnotic shadows flickering on the back wall of the cave. It is the unreal that is most real to them, as it was to me. I remember coming out of the dark picture house into the sunlight of the war's double summertime and feeling bereft that the dream was over. And I wasn't the only one who felt like that. In his poem Cahiers du Cinéma, Sean O'Brien captures the sense of expulsion we all felt when the movie ended and we went sadly home. He writes, "We watchers in the cave are cast out once for all into that fearful tea-time light where everything is being filmed and narrative has given way entirely to its critics who must read 1,000 screens at once for damning evidence of dreams." Of my generation of dreamers, Joan Didion is the best expositor of the closed romantic realism of the movies we were immersed in during those years. She and I fell for the same characters, John Wayne being the most archetypical. She started going to the cinema a few years later than me, during the summer of 1943, the year John Wayne starred in War of the Wildcats. She tells us that is when she first saw the actor who was known to his friends as the Duke. That's when she saw the walk and heard the voice telling the girl in the picture he would build her a house at the bend in the river where the cottonwoods grow. When Wayne died, she wrote about him in an essay she called A Love Song. It was less an obituary of the actor who had just died of cancer than an exposition of the dreams he had stimulated in those of us who had been watching him over the years. She writes, "When John Wayne rode through my childhood, and perhaps through yours, He determined forever the shape of certain of our dreams. It did not seem possible that such a man could fall ill, could carry within him that most inexplicable and ungovernable of diseases. The rumour struck some obscure anxiety, threw our very childhoods into question. In John Wayne's world, John Wayne was supposed to give the orders. "Let's ride," he said, "and saddle up, forward ho, and a man's got to do what he's got to do." "Hello there," he said, when he first saw the girl in a construction camp or on a train or just standing around on the front porch waiting for someone to ride up through the tall grass. When John Wayne spoke, there was no mistaking his intentions. He had a sexual authority so strong that even a child could perceive it. And in a world we understood early to be characterized by venality and doubt and paralyzing ambiguities, he suggested another world, one which may or may not have existed ever, but in any case existed no more, a place where a man could move free, could make his own code and live by it, a world in which if a man did what he had to do, he could one day take the girl and go riding through the draw and find himself home free, not in a hospital with something going wrong inside, not in a high bed with the flowers and the drugs and the forced smiles, but there at the bend in the bright river, the cottonwood shimmering in the early morning sun. Didion has captured here what it is that touches me when I read the obituaries of my boyhood heroes of the silver screen. What grabs me is the contrast between their idealized existence, their heroic presence on the screen, and the quotidian, often depressing reality of their lives off-screen. Didion found it impossible to associate illness with her image of John Wayne. But there was more to his human vulnerability than the cancer that killed him. He was bald, and he must have hated it, because off-screen as well as on he hid it beneath a toupee. It was as if he had lost the difference between the movie legend John Wayne and the boy Marion Morrison, born in a small Iowa town in 1907. And there was a more profound anomaly than the difference between his idealized physical beauty on the screen and the paunchy, balding man he became in real life. In his films, he always played the courageous and lonely hero who took up arms against the oppressor and his bandit gang. Yet in real life, he managed to finesse his way out of being drafted into the military in the Second World War. He looked like a hero, he walked and talked like a hero, but his heroics were all in the movies. John Wayne was an act. But he wasn't the only schoolboy crush I had, whose actual life was very different from the one I saw in the pictures. A good obituary can capture and explain these contrasts and help us sympathize with the forces that provoked them. After all, the actor is only a heightened version of the tendency in many of us to spend so much of our lives auditioning for roles we fancied that we never fully embraced the ones scripted for us. Marion Morrison wasn't John Wayne. He acted John Wayne, as do many of us in our own way. And that's fine, as long as we acknowledge the distance between the act and the real thing before it's too late. The tragedy is to die without knowing who you were, to keep the act going till the end. Like the student in a poem by Linda Pastan, who studied so long for life that she woke one morning to discover someone was already walking down the aisle collecting the papers. The beauty of getting near death is that it gives us a last shot at reality, at owning and admitting our real selves. When I was writing my memoir, Leaving Alexandria, I became aware that it had become an extended act of self-examination. I see no reason now to revise the verdict on myself I reached then. Like Peter the Apostle, maybe this is why he moves me so much, I have spent much of my life wanting and sometimes pretending to be the kind of person I admired but wasn't. I think of them as people who don't get in their own way, people who do not appear to bother very much about themselves. What they have in abundance is a capacity for application to the task in hand, whatever it is. They stick at things. As well as being the mark of the saint, this is also the mark of the great scholar. In a word, they possess patience. Patience has the same root as the word suffer. It is the ability to endure not only pain, but boredom, the grind of necessity. I was good at enduring physical pain, but bad at enduring dullness and lack of excitement. It manifested itself as an irritation with the boredom of the small print, the detail of the agenda, and a failure to finish things. Always an enthusiastic starter, I was too impatient to be a good finisher. My life has been littered with attempts to play musical instruments and learn languages and acquire technical understanding of the devices and machines I used without knowing how they worked. None of it was achieved to any level of accomplishment. Fortunately, there were a few occasions when there were people around me who were able to finish what I had impulsively started, and some good was done. The starter impulse is still there, and I occasionally give it a flourish by revisiting an old failure. And I wonder what that was all about. I try to console myself with Isaiah Berlin's parable of the fox and the hedgehog. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one important thing. The trouble is, I am neither fox nor hedgehog. I know a little about many things, but not a lot about anything. I see now that there was something visceral about my impatience, something that was part of my physical and psychological makeup, and it had a dark side. It made me a dangerous driver. I had 4 serious road accidents in my life, all of them my fault, 2 in motorbikes, 2 in cars, for one of which I had my license removed for a time. My wife Jeannie says my problem is I have a driven personality. It made me a risk-taker, impatient with any rules and processes that might slow me down. Even walking on the hills, I could never take it easy. I suppose it had some good sides to it. I was an editor's dream. I never missed a deadline, though my speed could make for sloppy writing, and I was good at chairing meetings, most of which go on far too long, and many of which are a waste of time anyway. Getting there was always the point for me. But where's there? And why the rush? I wonder now if I was catching up on myself after a tough start and a patchy education. Was I trying to prove that the random street boy could make it or fake it with the best of them? Looking back, what I regret most about the rush is missing so much of my own life. I don't mean missing it now, I mean missing it then, missing it while I was in the midst of it. I'm sorry I did not pay more attention to the world while I was racing through it, particularly to those who were close to me. I'm also sorry I was never the sort of boy who was fascinated by the natural world and busied himself in learning how it worked. I never studied birds, or watched butterflies, or explored the changes in frog spawn. On the hills, which I started walking as a very young boy, I didn't pay attention to what was actually around me. It was the movement that was important to me, as well as the dreams I was conjuring in my imagination as I strode on. This is the weakness of the romantic temperament. it spends too much emotional energy pursuing the elusive and fascinating other rather than concentrating on the gift that is actually close at hand. I wish more of my attention had been spent on the here of my life rather than on the elsewhere I was in pursuit of. Apart from my inherent impatience, I suspect that this tendency always to be looking ahead rather than looking around was intensified by catching the religious bug early. It diverted me into spending too much time trying to understand life rather than just living it. I was in my head rather than in the world. Rather than learning all I could about the world that enveloped me, a bit of me got diverted into obsessing about where it came from. Before he died a few years ago, I took this question to a philosopher friend I discussed these things with. Why is there something and not just nothing? Richard, he replied, there just is. Get used to it. Not that there has to be a conflict between these two fascinations, between the what and the where from. I know some who have kept them in perfect balance, fascinated both by the world's life and the mystery of its origins. I never achieved that balance. Now I regret not knowing what I was looking at when I did look at the earth and the creatures it nurtured, including the ones who nurtured me. That's why I am grateful to old age for slowing me down at last, and in Clive James' phrase, for helping me see the cosmic blaze and feel its grandeur before it's too late. I'm also glad I figured myself out before the end, though I wish I'd done it sooner. It would have helped me had I realized earlier that my acceleration system wasn't in sync with my braking system. But it was the life I was dealt, the cards I was given to play. No saint or scholar among them, but a few useful ones nevertheless. And I can say this, whatever else it lacked, my life was rarely boring. Still, I hope I have enough time left at the table to get better at what Nietzsche called amor fati, love of the fate I was dealt, the life that wove itself on the loom, the person I was. Maybe even to love him the way Derek Walcott the poet commanded. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you. The stranger who was yourself and who has loved you? It's intriguing the way poets are convinced some of us are destined to get to know and accept ourselves only when we are close to the final disclosure of death. Michael Donaghy said almost the same thing in the poem I have already quoted from. For the face they now cover is a stranger's, and it always has been. Befriending the stranger within, the stranger who was yourself, is an elusive but liberating idea to get hold of. But it can be difficult to understand. It's easier to grasp the importance of loving the stranger who is not yourself, though we find that just as hard to do. The letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament tells us why we should try. It says, "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." Fear of the stranger seems to be deep in the human psyche. Evolutionary psychologists suggest that it might even have had survival value during the childhood of our species. Sometimes they were out to get us. Wherever it came from, it can close our hearts and minds to the other and the good news they could be bringing us. That's why the unknown author of the letter to the Hebrews likened them to angels. And it's why the poet Louis MacNeice took the idea further. He wrote, "For every static world that you or I impose upon the real one must crack at times and new patterns from new disorders open like a rose, and old assumptions yield to new sensation. The stranger in the wings is waiting for his cue. The fuse is always laid to some annunciation. The poet tells us to be open to the strangers in our midst,